The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban. You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. Hymn to a Gothic Beauty, in which the renowned author of thrillers and mysteries praises Notre Dame, damaged by fire, but destined to inspire again. On September 1st, 1830, the 28-year-old poet Victor Hugo sat down to write Chapter 1 of a book called Notre Dame de Paris. His wife recalled he bought himself a bottle of ink and a huge gray knitted shawl which covered him from head to foot, locked away his formal clothes so that he would not be tempted to go out, and entered his novel as if it were a prison. Writers are often swathed in wool, by the way. We still sit all day, so we get cold. By the middle of January 1831, the book was astonishingly finished. Hugo had written something like 180,000 words in 4.5 months. It got poor reviews, but the public loved it. And it was quickly translated into other languages. The English edition was called The Hunchback of Notre Dame, a title at once more vulgar and more alluring, and Hugo became world famous. The quality of Hugo's writing is well illustrated by a passage in which he imagines, with spooky prescience, a fire at Notre Dame. All eyes were lifted to the heights of the church. What they saw was extraordinary. At the top of the highest gallery, above the rose window, a tall flame rose between the two bell towers with a tornado of sparks, a tall flame reckless and angry, from time to time shredded into the smoke by the wind. Below this flame, below the dark balustrade with its glowing leaves, two gutters vomited relentlessly through monster mouths a hard rain that gleamed silver against the dark facade. As they approached the ground, the two jets of liquid lead widened into multiple streamlets, like the spray from the thousand holes of a watering can. Above the flame, the vast towers, each harsh and sharply carved, one all black, the other all red, seemed even bigger because of the immense shadow they cast up to the sky. The innumerable sculptures of devils and dragons took on a dismal look. The restless brightness of the flames made them seem to fidget. There were laughing vipers, yapping gargoyles, salamanders, fanning the fire with their breath, and monsters that sneezed in the smoke. Nearly 200 years later, on April 15, 2019, I was in my kitchen at home when an old friend called. This friend had weathered many crises as a member of the British Parliament and a cabinet minister, but she sounded shocked. "I'm in Paris," she said. "Turn on your television." You know what we saw on the screen? Notre Dame was on fire. I understood what was burning and how the fire was gathering force, but the journalists commenting did not. And why should they? They had not studied the construction of Gothic cathedrals. I had, in doing research for The Pillars of the Earth, my novel about the building of a fictional medieval cathedral. A key scene in Chapter 4 describes the old cathedral of Kingsbridge burning down, and I had asked myself, exactly how does a great stone church catch fire? I had climbed into the dusty spaces under the roofs of cathedrals, including Canterbury and Florence. I had stood on the mighty beams that spanned the naves and looked at the rafters that supported the lead roof tiles. I had noticed the dried-up debris that often gathers in such places, old bits of wood and rope, sandwich wrappers left by maintenance workers, the knitted twigs of birds' nests, and the papery homes of wasps. On that spring night in 2019, I felt sure that the fire had started somewhere in the roof, probably when a dropped cigarette or a spark from an electrical fault ignited some litter, which in turn had set the timbers ablaze. Notre Dame had always seemed eternal, and the medieval builders certainly thought it would last until the Day of Judgment. But suddenly we saw that it could be destroyed. In the life of every boy, there is a painful moment when he realizes that his father is not all-powerful and invulnerable. The fall of the spire made me think of that moment. In 1163, the population of Paris was growing. On the right bank of the river, commerce was surging to levels unknown in the rest of medieval Europe, and on the left bank, the university was attracting students from many countries. Between the two, on an island in the river, stood a Romanesque basilica, and Bishop Maurice de Sully felt it should be bigger. And there was something else. There was an exciting new architectural movement that used pointed arches, letting more light into the building, a look now called Gothic. No doubt it made the older basilica with its round arches seem old-fashioned. So Sully ordered his church to be knocked down and replaced by a Gothic cathedral. Let me pause. All the above sounds straightforward, but in fact it is astonishing. The Cathedral of Notre Dame de Paris was erected in the Middle Ages, a time marked by violence, famine, and plague. The construction was a huge enterprise, lasting decades. It required hundreds of workers, and it cost a fortune. The huge building was erected by people who lived in wooden huts with straw roofs. The towers are 226 feet high, yet the builders did not have the mathematics to calculate the stresses in such structures. They proceeded by trial and error, and sometimes their work collapsed. We take for granted our ability to go to a hardware store and buy a perfectly balanced hammer with a steel head for a few dollars. But the tools of the cathedral builders were crude, and steel was so expensive that it was used very sparingly, often for only the tip of a blade. How did such majestic beauty arise out of the violence and filth of the Middle Ages? The first part of the answer is something almost always left out of any history of cathedrals, the weather. The years 950 to 1250 are known to climatologists as the medieval climatic anomaly. For 300 years, the weather in the North Atlantic region was better than usual. The evidence comes from tree rings, ice cores, and ocean sediments, all of which tell us about long-term weather changes in the past. There were still occasional years of bad harvest and famine, but on average, the temperature was higher. Warm weather meant more crops and wealthier people, and so Bishop Sully had money to begin his project. He hired at least two master builders who produced a design, but this was not drawn on paper. The art of making paper was new to Europe, and the product was an expensive luxury. Masons drew their designs on a tracing floor. Mortar was spread on the ground and allowed to harden. Then the plans were drawn with a sharp-pointed iron instrument, such as a nail. Suddenly, Paris needed more craftsmen and laborers, especially masons, carpenters, and mortar makers. As word got around, they began to come in from the provinces and beyond, from Italy and the Netherlands and England. There were women as well as men. The idea that women were too weak for this kind of work is nonsense, but women were plasterers and mortar makers more often than hammer and chisel masons. They frequently worked as part of a family team, husband and wife and older children, and it is easy to imagine the man cutting stone, the woman making mortar, and the teenagers fetching and carrying sand, lime, and water. The twin towers were in place by the 1240s. The rose windows, perhaps the best-loved feature of Notre Dame, were a late addition, begun in the 1250s. Probably the last phase was the casting of the bell. The cathedral was more or less built by 1260. But Bishop Sully had died in 1196. He never saw his great cathedral finished. We often catch our first glimpse of a cathedral from a distance. Our next reaction, as we come closer, is often confusion. It's a bit like the first time you hear a Beethoven symphony. There are so many melodies, rhythms, instruments, and harmonies that at first you can't grasp how they are linked and interrelated. A cathedral is like a symphony, has a coherent plan. Its windows and arches form rhythms. Its decorations have themes and tell stories. But the whole thing is so rich that at first it overwhelms us. When we step inside, this changes. Most people experience a sense of tranquility, the cool air, the ancient stones, the regular repetitions of the architecture, and the way the entire building seems to reach toward heaven, all work together to soothe the human soul. When Notre Dame was built, it drew support from every sector of medieval society, not just the clergy, but also aristocrats, business people, city dwellers, and rural agriculturalists. Everyone benefited. Jobs were created, commerce was strengthened, markets grew up, migration was stimulated, and new technology was invented. And yet, when you add up all the pragmatic reasons, they're not quite enough to explain why we did it. There is another element, which is the spiritual. The human beings need to aspire to something above the material life. A journalist once asked me, "Don't you hate all the tourists and their shorts and with their cameras?" No, cathedrals have always been full of tourists. In the Middle Ages, they were not called tourists, they were pilgrims, but they traveled for many of the same reasons, to see the world and its marvels, to broaden their minds, to educate themselves, and perhaps to come in touch with something miraculous. Our encounters with cathedrals are emotional. When we see them, we are awestruck. When we walk around, we are enraptured by their grace and light. When we sit quietly, we are possessed by a sense of peace. And when one burns, we weep. When Notre Dame's spire fell earlier this year, the French President Emmanuel Macron said Notre Dame would be rebuilt in 5 years. One of the French newspapers responded with a headline that translates, "Macron believes in miracles." But French attachment to Notre Dame is profound. Every road sign that tells you how far you are from Paris measures the distance to kilometer zero, a bronze star embedded in the pavement in front of Notre Dame. Besides, it is always unwise to underestimate the French. If anyone can do it, they can. That was Hymn to a Gothic Beauty by Ken Follett. Here is a sidebar to the article. Cue the cathedral. In a movie or even a video game, nothing says Paris like Notre Dame. And then there's four pictures from the film, different films. If I Were Free, and it's a picture of, I should know who these are, but I don't. The cathedral looming over Irene Dunn and Clive Brook in this 1933 romance was less than 4 feet tall. To create the novel effect, Notre Dame was painted on glass and lit from behind, and the Palais de Cité was built in miniature. The background was filmed first and projected behind the actors. The next frame shows the cathedral under construction. Hunchback of Notre Dame. I guess these are films. For the 1939 film, RKO spent $4.5 million in today's dollars to recreate the cathedral and other Paris settings on a California ranch. This Notre Dame was more than a facade, with stained glass and vaulted ceilings. At 190 feet, it stood just 30 feet shorter than the real thing. And the next frame has two dancers here. An American in Paris was the movie. Gene Kelly wanted to film the 1951 movie in the City of Light, but it cost less to paint its recognizable skyline on a 100-foot cyclorama surrounding the Culver City set. Notre Dame makes an appearance as Kelly and Leslie Caron sing Our Love is Here to Stay, and again during the 17-minute dance finale. And then the fourth and final frame is a picture from the movie Assassin's Creed Unity, or maybe that's a video game. It took video game artist Caroline Miosu 2 years to create a near-perfect digital replica of Notre Dame, circa 1789, for the 2014 game. The details are accurate, down to the paintings on the walls inside, but Miosu couldn't resist adding the iconic 19th-century spire. Next is Cherokee Harvest. For the first time, American Indians are being allowed to pick a cherished plant inside a national park. Tommy Cabe pulled a pipe from the leather pouch attached to his belt, lit it, and crouched close to the ground. Silently, he prayed that he might be nourished by eating the green-headed coneflower plant, or Sochan, S-O-C-H-A-N, growing all around him. To close his prayer, Cabe sprinkled a pinch of tobacco over the land of his ancestors. Cabe, a forest resource specialist for the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians and an enrolled tribal member in his 40s, grew up gathering Sochan, a traditional Cherokee food akin to but milder than spinach that is rich in vitamin C and folic acid. For years, Sochan gatherings was relegated to small backyard plots or along back roads. But one day this past May, clutching an official Hunter Orange harvest bag, Cabe stood on a forested hillside in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, where his tribe became the first in generations to legally collect Sochan within national park boundaries. Because of a new federal policy, 11 tribal members, as of now, are free to forage for Sochan in tens of thousands of acres inside the park. The lifting on the prohibition of such foraging marks a reconciliation of sorts, with the federal government finally acknowledging American Indians' claim to their ancestral homeland. For millennia, Cherokee inhabited vast portions of the Southeast, including the more than 500,000 acres of Tennessee and North Carolina that now form the national park. In 1830, the Indian Removal Act led to the forced eviction of tribes. Some families, including Cabe's, escaped by hiding in the Appalachians. Today, many of their descendants live in the Quala, Q-U-A-L-L-A, boundary tribe purchased land that shares a border with the park. When Congress established the National Park Service in 1916, it was illegal to remove any plants from within park borders. That changed in 1960 when some park superintendents began letting visitors gather certain nuts, berries, and fruits for personal consumption. But that policy and a 1983 update to it did not allow American Indians to forage for traditional cultural purposes, outside of rare exceptions made in historic treaties. But after an Arizona healer was cited in the early 1990s for taking plants from a national park for ceremonial use, the Park Service began reconsidering an overhaul of the regulation. In 2016, the Park Service invited federally recognized tribes to apply for permission to gather plants for traditional purposes. Before a single leaf is picked, the Park Service conducts an environmental assessment to ensure that the plant's future growth remains unharmed. Before he clipped his first Shoshan leaf, Cabe turned his attention uphill, where a field crew of five park employees was carefully counting the rosettes, circular arrangements of leaves, that the plants produce in the spring. These surveys will give the park a baseline to gauge the health of the Shoshan population at the end of each season. Before the gathering program, many members of the federal crew recognized the yellow-petaled green-headed coneflower, but most of them were not familiar with its Cherokee name or its cultural significance as a food. When the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians said, "We want to harvest Shoshan," we said, "How do you do it?" "How much do you harvest?" says park technician Joshua Albrighton, the field crew leader. Researchers have shown that the traditional Cherokee method of gathering Shoshan, which removes the low-growing spring basil leaves, is sustainable. Shoshan is only the first of many plants the tribe hopes to secure rights to gather. The Park Service is studying the sustainability of collecting ramps, pungent wild plants similar to leeks. Branch lettuce might be next. Around the country, other federally recognized tribes are seeking authorization to forage wild plants on federal parkland. According to the new guidelines, a person gathering Shoshan can collect one bushel each week from March until May and must give a portion of it to other tribal members. Cabe's share is going to Cherokee Choices, a diabetes prevention program that promotes whole traditional foods. On his drive home, Cabe handed over his allotment of the plant to Tyson Sampson, his friend and a community researcher for the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. By the time Cabe arrived at Sampson's house for lunch the next day, Sampson had already soaked and boiled the Shoshan and sautéed it in bacon grease. Sampson shouted a Cherokee greeting as Cabe entered the kitchen. "Sayo," spelled S-I-Y-O. Sampson began learning the language, an endangered one, the same way he learned how to cook Shoshan, from his elders. Sampson, an enrolled tribal member, grew up in Kuala Boundary, but it wasn't until he was an adult living in nearby Asheville, North Carolina, that he introduced friends to Shoshan and began to see foraging as a part of a cultural narrative. "When I was young, I was on a path to disconnect from my culture. Food was my way back in," he says. "I didn't know there was anything special about eating weeds." He prepared the Shoshan with traditional accompaniment: lye dumplings, boiled corn cakes. "Food culture, language culture, spiritual culture, it's all connected," Sampson says. He held up a dish laden with the staples of his childhood, calling them by name. Shoshan. I won't try to pronounce these others. Ramps, poke, a leafy green plant that must be boiled 3 times before eating. Sampson's perfectly round lye dumplings, also known as S-E-L-U-I-T-S-A-G-A-D-U, shone like full moons over mounds of green. "Every time someone mentions Shoshan," he says, "they're speaking Cherokee." Cabe, too, feels that the plant connects him to history. "When I eat Shoshan, it makes me feel clean, refreshed. It makes me feel happy that I'm Cherokee. The government forced us to assimilate. They made us cut our hair. They made us speak their language. But they didn't succeed in removing us. Shoshan is still here, and so are we." And this article has a sidebar called "Prized Plants, a Sampler of Other National Park Flora Treasured by American Indians" by April White. And it's got 6 pictures. One is called "Sweet Flag, a citrus-scented herb once used by Native Americans and colonists." The Cree chewed the roots as a stimulant found in marshes in the northern U.S. Number two is yarrow, Y-A-R-R-O-W, a common flowering plant known for its medicinal properties. In the Chippewa tradition, the leaves are steeped and the steam inhaled to treat headache pain. Might have to try that. Three, ramps, R-A-M-P-S, a wild relative of shallots, popular at trendy restaurants and part of Cherokee cuisine. Great Smoky Mountain National Park may allow gathering. And number four, and that was Cherokee Harvest by Lee Ann Henyon, H-E-N-I-O-N. And in the last minute or so, some comments from readers. My interest in marine biology took a leap forward after reading Steinbeck's Tortilla Flat, Cannery Row, and Sweet Thursday. Doc, a character in Cannery Row based on Ed Ricketts, never forever romanticized what it was to be a marine biologist. Ed, wherever you are, I truly hope you are enjoying your beer milkshakes. David Zitten from Cupertino, California. And Deanna Cluck from Austin, Texas writes, I had no idea that this side of Steinbeck existed. It gave me hope that with people like John Craig, with the help of the Western Flyer, there may yet be hope for our oceans. Cosmic Concern, Eileen Miracle of Santa Clara, California writes, it was inspirational to read about the unconventional background of the young astrophysicist James O'Donohue in Saturn's Surprise. But I doubt anyone alive today is sweating bullets over the predicted demise of Saturn's rings in a mere 100 million years. But then, California will most likely have become an island off the coast of Nevada, and people will have gone the way of dinosaurs, because of Yellowstone explosions. Breakfast of Champions. My great-grandfather was a baker who served leftover pie for breakfast. Every morning after Thanksgiving, someone in our family will be eating pie and mumbling, it's a tradition, right? Laura Peebles, Arlington, Virginia, wrote that. Well, it's certainly been my pleasure and honor to read for you today. We hope you've enjoyed today's readings of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, you can hear this program and our other readings on our website.